Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Harris, Judge Halbrooks. The Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning. And welcome to this October 23rd, 2024 panel of the Court of Appeals. We have four cases for consideration today, three of which will be deciding after oral argument and one by non-oral disposition. Our first case on the calendar this morning is Vizzetti versus City of Minneapolis. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we do keep an audio recording of the proceedings for the benefit of the public. Be mindful of the timing restrictions. They're indicated in the light and clock in the lectern, which you can raise or lower to your height for your convenience. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to go, you have the floor.
Good morning. My name is Greg Sauter, and I am an assistant city attorney for the City of Minneapolis, and I am here representing appellant City of Minneapolis today. Minneapolis brought this interlocutory appeal because it believes the district court was mistaken when it denied its motion to dismiss based on official immunity. The district court was mistaken for two primary reasons. First, it mistakenly reasoned that the officer's duty under the relevant policy to exercise caution and due consideration for the safety of the public was a ministerial duty because it was preceded by the word shall in the policy. Second, it was mistaken that there is an issue of material fact on whether the officers fulfilled their ministerial duties to operate lights and sirens continuously under the same policy when it concluded that the video was inconclusive as to whether or not the siren was activated the whole time. Official immunity is ideally immunity from suit, not just an affirmative defense at summary judgment. It is appropriate on the complaint as written to take the issue up now. The agreed upon facts and legal issues in this case are actually quite substantial. Mr. Vizzetti has not contested Minneapolis's claim to vicarious official immunity. The issue is whether or not the officers who are not named are entitled to immunity. The parties agree that there are no allegations of malice in the complaint, so that is an issue that doesn't need to be taken up today. There is no dispute whether officers responding to an emergency are authorized to speed, to pass through red lights, and drive in oncoming lanes of traffic, which were done and is clearly visible on the video provided that was mentioned in the complaint and provided to the court as part of the record.
Just so we're clear, you recognize, or your position is that there's a conflict apparently between what's in the allegations in the complaint and the video as it regards the lights and siren?
Yes, there is, Your Honor. And actually, and specifically, the complaint doesn't actually allege that in those last half a second or less, the lights and sirens were off. And I would defer to the complaint as what it says. But when the video clearly shows that the lights and sirens were activated, the complaint could allege something else, but under Scott v. Harris, established by our U.S. Supreme Court, the court is not limited to the allegations, or even a self-serving deposition or something like that. The court can look to the video, and the video is something that's referenced in the complaint. So under the Northern States Power case, the court can consider that video.
Counsel, I agree that the video is referenced. So I guess the question that I have for you is that when you have a video that perhaps you may see lights and sirens, but then you also have triggers which are indicating lights and sirens are not activated, is that enough of a factual dispute to support the district court's determination that that is inconclusive?
Your Honor, I'd like to talk about the issue of the triggers themselves. The city admits that there is a dispute over those last seven frames about whether or not the siren was issued, because you have the trigger that says one, and one can listen with one's own ears to hear the siren. But when the siren is clearly audible, the trigger, whether it says the siren is on and off, is irrelevant. When the lights are clearly visible, which they are throughout this incident, the trigger for lights is off. But when it comes down to it, Your Honor, the city asks that the court defer to the video and their own ears and eyes. But
Counsel, I agree. I'm going to be frank. I watched the video. It's at least clear to me that you can see the red and blue of the sirens. You can hear, of the lights. You can hear the sirens. But I guess my question more is, the court made a finding that it's inconclusive based partially on the triggers and based on what the court saw. So as an error correcting court, is there an abuse of discretion or can we find her finding that it's inconclusive, whether she abused her discretion given the discrepancy between the trigger and the lights and sirens being visible and audible and watching?
Your Honor, is the city's belief, and it's in our briefing, I don't have the case right at mind, but this review is a de novo review, not an abuse of discretion review. So the court can, if it finds the video conclusive, state that the video, find that it's conclusive, regardless of what the district court ruled.
Well, it's usually de novo as a matter of fact, but what, or as a matter of law, but when there's a factual component like this, is there a clear error component of the analysis?
Your Honor, the court and the appeals court is looking at this case from a light most favorable to the allegations in the complaint.
Yes.
We have the video, and where the video clearly contradicts the allegations of the complaint, the video can trump that, Your Honor. And when it comes down to that inconclusiveness, the city is not going to concede the inconclusive issue, because when the city watches the video, it's the city's position that throughout the sound and lights can be heard and observed. But when it comes down to this, I would direct the court's attention to the Thompson case, which is extensively briefed in the complaint. It's Thompson versus City of Minneapolis. In that case, the court was looking at a police pursuit where a pursuit had been initiated and there was an issue about whether or not the officers had used lights and sirens continuously. The officers were claiming they only turned on their lights and sirens to go through red lights. The suspect who was being followed said, no, they were right behind me the whole time. And the issue in that case was whether or not the failure of lights and sirens, there was an issue of official immunity, but more important and cognizant to that complaint was whether or not the pedestrian heard or should have heard the sirens. And with the lights and sirens off, they claimed they didn't hear the sirens and they got hit by the fleeing officer. And Thompson established a rule, our Supreme Court did, quote, if the officers violated section 4.05 of the policy, a fact unclear from the record, then they are not entitled to official immunities for claims arising from the non-use of emergency lights and sirens. What is clear in this case, and what distinguishes this case substantially, is up until those seven or fewer frames where that light, that siren indicator is off, it is clear that the siren was activated the whole time. It is clear when the truck pulls over that they know that there's a police officer behind them. It is clear that when plaintiff's companion pulls over to allow the officers to pass that they were behind him. And it's also clear when plaintiff made the decision to make a left turn to get out of the way of the officers, which was an illegal move, that he knew the officers were behind him and overtaking him.
Well, it may be an illegal move. You're not saying it's, I mean,
it's not part of the appeal.
You're right. I mean, we're when drivers are responding to an emergency vehicle, I mean, they pull off onto the shoulder. They'll pull off. I mean, they'll do things that might appear to be illegal, but it's an attempt to let the officer get around. You're not suggesting that was an Well, I don't know. I don't know what exactly you're suggesting by saying that it was an illegal turn.
Your Honor, that will be an issue we'll take up on summary judgment should this pursue further and would take up with a fact finder. But that is an issue that was briefed but was not part of this appeal.
All right.
Your Honor. In their reply, plaintiff mentioned snowplow cases. And there are two snowplow cases, or in their opposition, two snowplow cases that actually sort of take the Thompson rule, where we talk about whether or not it's directly linked to the cause, further. In snowplow cases, courts have disregarded similar attempts to pick out alleged ministerial duties violated for, and still granted official immunity. In Milkey v. Miller, which is in the briefing, they granted immunity even though the officer failed to check to see if there was traffic coming from left to right, because it was all part of the fundamental action. And then Steele versus Lefevre, which was recently decided by this court, the officer never looked at the stop sign and rolled right, or not the officer, but the snowplow driver never looked at the stop sign and rolled right out. While he had discretion to go and make that choice to go through the stop sign, no choice was made because he was checking out a bump, a thud that happened with the vehicle. And the court looked at that one ministerial act and said, that doesn't change the fact that immunity is here. And here we have, assuming that somehow the siren was turned off that seven or fewer frames from the accident, that had nothing to do with what the accident is. The video is clear that by the time that motorcycle was in front of the squad and it was aggressively braking, it was going to hit that motorcycle.
Can you address the district court's analysis on the other part of the city's policy, shall use caution and
yes, Your
protect
Honor.
Safety or whatever that language is?
Do you mind if I just interject one moment?
Sure.
Just before you leave that first issue, Mr. Sutter, when you say assuming, you know, that it was turned off, I assume you're making an alternative argument here, but doesn't the video show a continuous siren, whether it's pulsating or some other type of level?
Absolutely.
I just want to be clear on that.
Judge Helbrooks, yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. It does. It depicts audio. Mm-hmm. One can hear the siren throughout until the accident, and then after the strike, the siren is off.
Okay. And one
can tell that by after things settle down. You don't hear the siren, but you still see the lights flashing.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
But, Your Honor, going to the issue of shall, I'd like to direct your attention to the Vassallo X. Rel. Brown versus Majeski case. In that case, one looks at in talking about official immunity, it talked about whether the court looks at the conduct of the issue, whether the conduct is discretionary or ministerial, and if discretionary, whether or not the conduct was willful or malicious. 7.401D does create a duty to exercise due caution. Officers performing emergency driving shall exercise caution and due consideration for the safety of the public. Shall, in this policy's context, is a mandatory requirement that officers involved in emergency driving use their judgment. The audio feed of the video clearly shows that the officers were working together as a team in order to safely move. When they make that left turn before they get onto Minnehaha Parkway, one officer is yelling out. And in the Vassallo case, it talked about other rules and other policies similar to this, shall use caution, shall this, and basically said this is the essence of discretion. This, by telling an officer to basically what the rule is and the based on the way it's structured, the policy is asking the officers to use their judgment. So, and in doing that, Vassallo, when they did that, they were actually, in one point, was quoting the Thompson case that I discussed earlier on that. So when it comes down to it, The court simply got it wrong when it said shall exercise caution, due consideration. And one important fact about that Vassallo case is that whether or not that discretion was abused is not an issue. Even if there's evidence that the officers were acting incorrectly or being overly aggressive or something like that, that is not the issue here at looking at official immunity. They had discretion to make those decisions about how they drove and how they proceeded to the scene. And when the court is looking at official immunity, we're not looking at whether or not that immunity was abused. Without any further questions.
No, if I understand you correctly, you seem to be suggesting that the officer could perhaps be subject to discipline for violating the policy to use discretion in a certain way, but would not alter the officer's or diminish the officer's reliance on official immunity as a basis to avoid liability.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly true. And it's something that I have seen in my practice, but that's not relevant to this case. But when it comes down to it, the city still has its disciplinary system. The officer's conduct is still looked at. And that concludes my time, Your Honor.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Will Flegel, and along with Jake Jagfeld, we represent the respondent, Mr. Vizzetti, in this matter and urge the affirmance of the trial court's decision. In this case, fundamentally, the issue becomes what is the standard of review on an official immunity challenge and who has the burden of proof for that immunity? That would be the movement in this case that has the burden of proof. Under the standard of review that's applicable to a Rule 12 motion, the facts as pled in the complaint are taken as true. If this was converted to a Rule 56 motion because of the introduction of Trooper Schwartzbauer's affidavit, then the facts are construed from the record in the light most favorable to plaintiff.
Didn't the plaintiff include the video as or reference the video as part of the complaint?
The video was referenced in the complaint, at least in a general fashion. And I believe that the video itself would be considered under recent decisions of this court to be embraced within the pleadings and therefore would be part of it. The only thing that would convert this to a Rule 56, if you scrutinize it, is Officer Schwartzbauer's testimony that continuous operation does not include pulsing. To expand that fact issue on whether there was compliance with D4 regulation.
And so based on that, Mr. Flegel, because the video was referenced in the complaint, that would be proper for our consideration as well.
Yes, absolutely it would.
Just to be clear, what you're saying is, your contention is that what cannot be part of our analysis is the meaning of continuous as it relates to a pulsating siren.
Because that's always going to be a fact issue under any issue, under any standard of review that applies.
So, all right, so what, if that is the only issue, assume for the sake of argument that your client doesn't persuade us on any other issue. What would be the disposition as to the appeal?
If I'm following you, and I may have you replow that ground, but if I'm following you, the disposition would be that would be an affirmance because the matters pled in the complaint are a cognizable negligence claim. We alleged violations of the standards applicable to secure official immunity. In paragraph 26 at page 7 in document 1, we allege a general violation of policy. That would be under a Rule 12 analysis assumed to be true and that we could produce facts later. There's been no discovery in this case, Your Honor. But so if the matter proceeded to discovery, then under a Rule 12 standard of review, you would assume we have provable facts to document that. If we're not doing a Rule 12 analysis, if we do a Rule 12 analysis, we win. If we do a Rule 56 analysis and include Trooper Schmaltzbauer's affidavit, then we expand fact issues and are given the benefit of the most favorable interpretation of those fact issues, and we win. We were in an interesting posture as to whether we talk about Rule 56 or not, but worried that the court may dispose of the matter on other bases than those which the trial court chose to do. She viewed this exclusively as a Rule 12 motion and determined she did not need to reach Officer Schmaltzbauer's affidavit. She did not consider it. But under Rule 1202, the fact that either party introduced additional material arguably converted that motion from a Rule 12 to Rule 56, slightly modifying the standard of review. But we can't lose in a situation where we introduce a fact and the obligation under Rule 56 is for the movement to demonstrate there are no fact issues. Producing more facts does not decrease a fact issue. So I'm sorry for the lengthy explanation, but under either standard, the plaintiff should prevail and there should be affirmance here.
Based on that, though, help me with this, because it seems like I understand the Rule 12 standard where we take what's in the complaint as true at that stage. But if there seem to be contradictory things in the record, and what we're looking at is immunity, which of course bars a claim, how would you ever then reach an immunity determination under that analysis?
There's more law on this in the federal law than there is in state law. But fundamentally, just by example, in federal law, typically what's permitted is what's jurisdictional discovery, where some amount of information is developed so that the court, whether it's the trial court or an appellate court, has a record on which to rely. Otherwise, you're forced as an appellate court to engage in fact-finding, which is not your task, typically. Usually, instead, what occurs is the court looks at the record, and under the appropriate standard of review for Rule 12, it's whether there was an allegation in the complaint. Now, we expand the complaint, let's say, for purposes of analysis to embrace the video. Well, that's a clear fact issue, because if you look at that complaint, we have if you look at the video, we have indications where we can hear a siren and the siren is labeled as off in the triggers. And we have the reciprocal of that. That casts into doubt the accuracy of that document, which inherently requires a fact finder to resolve. So if we
had... Wait a second, you're saying you're saying a fact finder would be necessary to determine at a Rule 12 stage, the dispute between a written complaint that says no volume, no siren, and the actual siren. I think the volume is especially loud. I don't know if you can control that.
That's, I think, just you, because I turned it up due to my hard hearing.
I don't think I can control my...
You have a very good...
My volume, but I think we can turn it. All right, thank you.
So, if I may, I was answering Judge Hallbrook's question about how we would deal with a circumstance where we're debating a fact issue, and any fact issue requires a fact finder to resolve. If we look at this solely as a Rule 12 question, then it's just, what did the complaint say? The complaint said that there was a violation of policy. Does that state an actionable case? Yes. Verdict for the plaintiff at this stage procedurally. In the event that the debate proceeds now we have to determine whether or not their lights were off, whether the siren was on. Those inherently require the resolution of a fact finder. And in federal...
Even if we could look at what was... Even if the video is part of the pleadings, we construe it that way, you're saying if we, as a court, can observe the video and hear a siren, and the complaint says the siren wasn't on, you're saying that's a fact dispute that goes to the benefit of the plaintiff as a non-moving party?
I'm saying we created a fact issue.
So, counsel, by just merely stating a fact, regardless of whether or not that fact can be disproved, you're indicating that just creates a fact finding such that we just don't consider what we can see and hear?
Okay. I apologize for not making this clearer. We begin with a Rule 12 analysis because this was a Rule 12 motion. There, the predicate to your question applies. We're just looking at what's in the pleading. Now we take Judge Hallbrook's observation about the video.
And counsel, in the pleading, however, there's reference to the video. So again, the video is part of the pleading.
Bingo.
Right?
Yep.
So then we can look to the video and just presume for argument's sake that the video shows that the lights were clearly illuminated and that you can hear the video and the sirens are clearly blaring. Because you indicate in your complaint, you state that they're not on, you reference the video, and the video, for sake of argument, the lights and sirens are on. What are we going to rely on?
Yeah. The issue, just to reword it, is what do we do where the video, which is, let's assume for purposes of our discussion, part of the record, what do we do if the video presents us with inconsistent information? That's what I'm trying to address. Because there are portions of the video where the trigger indicators show that something is happening,
but
we can't hear it. What do we do in the presence of that issue?
I guess the question is that inconsistent information? If what we're trying to determine is whether or not lights are illuminated, and my eyes can see a video and I can see red and blue lights illuminated, is that inconsistent? It seems to me like that is consistent with the only finding, that being that the lights were on. Irregardless of whether or not there's a trigger or something saying the lights were off. Again, I can say that that wall is black, but if my eyes see that that wall is white, is there an inconsistency there?
I'm going to take issue with one area of your focus. Let's not care about the lights.
Fine, let's go with the sirens.
Right.
I can hear that the sirens are on.
And what happens, we're on the video, as you hear the sirens, the bar below indicates sirens off. What do you do? Don't you conclude there's an inconsistency here that requires a fact finder?
If you're correct, a plaintiff could always create a fact dispute that avoids official immunity simply by stating something in the complaint that may be objectively, obviously wrong based upon video that is also included as part of the pleadings by reference in the complaint. Is that correct? Give me an example of a circumstance where that wouldn't be correct under your reasoning.
I'm sorry, give me that again, please, Judge Ross.
Give me an example where that would not be the case under your argument.
Where what would not be the case, sir?
Where you could, as a plaintiff, create a fact dispute to avoid official immunity simply by stating something in the complaint that is objectively inconsistent with what your eyes and ears inform you when viewing a video that's referenced in the complaint and is therefore part of the pleadings.
I think the thing that I'm going to try to answer your question as directly as I can, but I think the thing that's leading us a bit astray here is this is a Rule 12 motion, which is extremely unusual procedurally in the context of official immunity. Almost all the time it's a summary judgment standard where we are engaged in an active debate about whether there's a fact issue or not.
Well, the whole point of official immunity is not just to avoid liability. It's immunity from even defending the case at all.
It's immunity from suit.
Right. So if you're saying that the defendant always has to go through discovery and participate significantly. You know it's an expensive part of the litigation to go through discovery before you get to the official immunity question. I don't know that that's consistent with the law. You can convince me I'm wrong.
Okay. I know in the federal system, there we allow at least what you might call, what I call jurisdictional discovery, but what you might call immunity discovery.
Well, the difference there, I would suggest, might be based upon a distinction between official immunity under state law and qualified immunity under federal law, which are they're different legal questions, aren't they?
Yes.
So wouldn't the qualified immunity almost necessarily involves the subjective information and more discovery?
What would a reasonable officer do?
Right.
My point in the remaining minute that I have is the takeaway here is we are looking, regardless of the standard of review that applies, for whether or not the officers arguably deviated from a policy, because we know under Thompson, you never have discretion as a police officer to depart from the established policy that's a policymaker.
From a ministerial policy.
And in Thompson, the court held that the continuous lights and siren rule is ministerial. So if we can prove a violation of that, then the answer to your question is yes. 100% of the time, a violation of a ministerial policy deprives you of official immunity, even under a Rule 12 standard.
Under this unique circumstance of pulsating versus continuous.
Which we contend we created a fact issue on with Officer Schmoltz.
Do you concede that with regard to the lights question, were the lights on?
We never argued about lights, because the focus is on, I've only got 5 seconds here, but I
understand you didn't concede it, but you recognize, I just want to know whether you acknowledge.
Yes, sir.
That is, whether you had argued it or not, it would be a loser argument.
We tried to make this as straightforward and simple as possible, and the focus was simply on the issue of the siren. Believing we created a fact issue about that, whether it's summary judgment or whether it's Rule 12, we should prevail. If there's a difference in the interpretation of the facts, we've advanced from a Rule 12 motion to Rule 56, and that requires a fact finder.
On the limited question of whether the siren was on continuously.
Did we create an issue about that? And as to continuance, the continuation of the siren, that's the role that Officer Schmoltzbauer plays here. If you have a further question, I'll be glad to answer it, but I'm past my time.
I believe we do have one more. We have multiple questions, so stand firm.
Yes, sir.
Judge Albrooks?
Did you have one also, Judge Harris?
You can go first.
Okay. So help me with this. There are two sections of this policy manual that have been the source of focus here. And one, and the question is, we look at the conduct, right? This is our analysis. And then we look at whether that's ministerial or discretionary. The district court judge seemed very focused on the mandatory term shall in both of these sections. What if, to say, this is hypothetical, we have not talked about this case, if we disagree that the word shall in the section that talks about exercising due care in terms of, you know, the actual driving and that sort of thing, if we feel that that narrowed the interpretation of ministerial improperly, and that it really is a discretionary function, then how would that completely impact your analysis?
This is going to be more than a 30-second answer, if that's permissible.
That's permissible.
Okay. One of the guides that will help you is the Ireland versus Crow's Nest case, which talks about converting a shall into a may. That'll give you a predicate to work from. But let's first recognize what the trial judge did here. She's looking at the use due care, which sounds discretionary, and saying it's preceded by the word shall. But what is the example that she cites in her memorandum for what the shall was, what the standard of conduct was that was violated or that she feels arguably deviated from the established policy? It is looping back to the continuous lights and siren. In other words, shall use due care implies a reasonable standard. What would define reasonableness? The standard of what a person would do under the circumstance. Would an officer ever act reasonably if they deviated from another policy, continuous lights and siren. No, they would not. That's what would violate it, that second due care. Due care is inherently a discretionary sounding thing, whether it's preceded by the word shall or not, but where it establishes that you shall do a reasonable thing, when would ever violating a policy be a reasonable thing? It would not. And the policy she's talking about there is the lights and siren one. Our case, I kept using lights after I criticized you, Judge Harris, but it's siren. Can we prove that the siren was arguably on or not, given the inconsistency even within the video?
But counsel, isn't it, I guess it wasn't just due care, it was that to exercise caution and due care. It seems to me that exercising caution and due care are both subjective. So I guess the question I'm asking is, it seems to me that perhaps the district court didn't fully apply the immunity doctrine, that being the behavior that we're talking about is really the conduct and nature of the officer's driving. Am I wrong there?
Pretty much to right on. I can quibble, but I'm going to accept your premise if you've got a question.
No, I'm just, that's the question.
Okay.
It's the driving conduct that we're talking about.
Yes. The first issue in any official act immunity issue is, what is the conduct at issue?
The conduct.
This is driving conduct. There's a mandate. You can pursue, you can respond to an emergency anytime you feel prudent. But when you do, what do you have to do? And keep the siren on continuously.
So within that driving conduct, the operation of the siren, that is a ministerial, you would say that's a ministerial duty because you just...
The Supreme Court said it was in Thompson.
And then the additional driving conduct, you would agree that's discretionary?
I'm sorry?
The additional driving conduct.
That is not the focus of where we are today procedurally.
Well, I understand. My question is, would you agree that the additional conduct, driving conduct, is discretionary?
How fast they go and what streets they choose and all of that driving conduct, I would agree with that. The one thing they cannot do is pulsate or have something other than continuous operation of lights and siren. There's a fact issue on that. I'm past my freshness date. So, anything else? Thank you for your questions today.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal? I'm guessing the answer is yes. You've got papers in your hand. You're loaded up.
Your Honor, I was debating on whether or not to...
And again, just for the record, go ahead and give us your name.
My name is Gregory Sauter, Assistant City Attorney. And the court and Judge Harris, you asked a relevant and important question here. What is the conduct at issue here? Is it turning off the lights, or is it attempting to pass a motorcycle at high speed while emergency driving? And it's attempting to pass a motorcycle at high speed while emergency driving. And for that... official immunity applies because this is discretionary conduct.
Well, let's get to the issue. I think that seems to be the more narrowly focused question on appeal, which is the question, which is, as I understand it, you have an audio of and a video that lets us hear and see the circumstance of the lights and siren. And the argument is, if I understand it from the respondent, is that you've got a fact question regarding whether the officer's conduct actually meets the policy requirement, the ministerial duty to have the siren on continuously. Leaving the lights aside, I believe that's been conceded.
Yes, Your Honor, and you've addressed... answering your question, when one looks at the video... the indicator goes off 7 or fewer frames. We said 7 in our briefing. I went and looked at the video yesterday. It happened 3. It's inconsistent about when it goes off when one looks at the video. But it's less than half a second beforehand. But here...
The trigger light.
Mm-hmm. When one listens to the video, the siren can be heard the entire time. That pulse, the wail, whatever one calls it, it's a continuous sound. And going back to the Scott v. Harris... in this case, it's not inappropriate to defer to the video when an allegation of the complaint is blatantly contradicted.
So you would ask us to interpret the audio portion of the video as not being pulsating, but being continuous.
Yes, Your Honor, because it's when the officers turn the corner, it goes from a standard sine wave siren to a much more insistent siren. And at that point, that is still a continuous siren. There is sound made throughout. And the sound is actually meant to...
So do you agree that we should not consider the officer's affidavit?
Your Honor, this is a motion to dismiss that is before the court, not a motion for summary judgment that is before the court. And the officer's affidavit was offered by the plaintiff. It is outside the complaint, and the court was correct in considering the video and the policy on this, and we would object to that consideration. The city also offered another document to be considered that was outside the complaint, and that document about police speeds was not considered either, and the court was appropriate in making that decision. And Your Honor, I gave you sort of a jumble of words when I was talking about Vassallo earlier, but Vassallo case actually has, quote, the requirement to use due care also calls for the exercise of independent judgment. Those just choices made while driving call for independent judgment. The decision to turn off a siren or not, there are exceptions that when it's allowed, but for purposes of this motion, that is a ministerial duty. And
in other words, the term ordinarily regards unusual circumstances.
Right.
You're driving to the scene of a hostage, you know, you don't want, or a burglary in progress. You don't want to alert the assailant. That's what ordinarily is not part of this case because this isn't that circumstance. Is what you're
this
saying.
Is not the disordinarily, the exception right. to the policy. So there's no decision here. And whether or not official immunity can be taken up on summary judge or on motion dismiss, I have two cases, one that is currently in briefing before this court and another in which this court issued an opinion, Arianna Anderson and Sharon Faulkner, where official immunity was granted on a motion to dismiss, and we hope to be sustained in the Arianna Anderson one, and was sustained by the Court of Appeals in this case. This is not uncommon for official immunity to be considered here. Plaintiffs are doing what the plaintiff in Scott v. Harris did. They're blatantly contradicting what's in the video, and for that, the court should defer to the video. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sauter, Mr. Flegel. Well briefed, well argued. We appreciate good advocacy. It helps us to narrow our focus and decide the issues before us. Difficult case, but we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. It's under advisement. Thank you.
Thank you.
And have a good rest of your day.